S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that loves a rate cut, at least because we've got mortgages to pay, as much as you do. I'm Scott Phillips, and as always, is any bun Mahanti. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, well, I'm not good yet, although my bank tells me there'll be a rate cut announcement from them today. So possibly, by the time this is up on air, I'll feel much, much better, because I'll hopefully be paying a little bit less on my mortgage.
You know what I did? I asked my bank,
good man,
just a day or two before the rate cut, to give me a better deal.
And what did they do?
Well, they said they're going to get back to me. They haven't gotten back to me.
I should at least pass on the 25 basis points then.
Well,
I'm pretty comfortable you'll get a rate cut, I reckon.
I want more than that.
You always do, dude.
Yeah.
And you asked me for a pay rise, which is nice. So that's a good way to start the podcast this Friday morning. We hope you've had a good week, listeners, because if you've got a mortgage, hopefully soon enough you'll be paying less on your loan. Unfortunately, if you've got cash in the bank, well, rates can't go much lower, mate. They're kind of... At-call rates are effectively zero. Term deposit rates are hard to see from this distance. You need a magnifying glass to see the term deposit rates at the moment.
Well, you know, in some countries, you actually pay the bank to keep your money. And the bank pay you to borrow the money.
We'll get into that. All right, on this week's podcast, we are going to talk, funnily enough, about the rate cut. Not for too long. Don't switch off. We've got some interesting things to say. We'll talk a little bit about the kind of broader macro issues. Why are the rates being cut? How are households responding? Also, a little bit of kind of looking into the banks, those that passed on the rate cut, those that didn't, and why that might have been. We'll talk about Vocus. We'll talk about China's infant formula market and the new hurdles there for some of our best and brightest, our most exciting and, frankly, highest flying stocks in the country. And Afterpay has kind of caught the attention of the regulator. We'll talk about that a little bit. And if we have time, we'll jump into the Motley Fool mailbag. Let's get on with it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
So, mate, Glenn Stevens, parts company with the RBA, 3 years on from the last rate cut, Phil Lowe finally has something to do. He finally, the RBA board, after 3 years of meeting, having jam and scones and coffee and tea and then kind of wondering about doing anything, they've finally cut rates from 1.5 to 1.25. And it's very possible, if you listen to Governor Lowe's comments, that there's at least one more coming down the pike. What's going on?
Well, it looks like, you know, they also had whiskey.
What gives you that impression? Are you saying they've been reckless? Is that what you're telling me? They've got drunk and then cut the rates. Is that what you're alleging here, Doc?
I think
there's our headline. Doc alleges RBA drunk when making rate cut decision. I'm liking that.
I was of the view that, you know, they should have increased rate. Well, okay, so I wouldn't fault cutting the rate, but I would fault them for not having increased the rate. That's number one.
All right, let's take that out. Let's pass that a little bit. So, a good decision to cut the rates. Why?
Well, you know, the economic activity kind of looks slow. People are not spending, right? People are holding back. So, I mean, you know, consumers are being frugal, right? So they're being the Grinch. So if consumers are not being good, we've also seen a number of, you know, on the IT side, a number of IT services company report soft numbers, which suggests that there's, you know, business spending slowdown. Yep. So there's a slowdown. When there's a slowdown, well, what can RBA do? Well, you know, one of the things it can do, one of the tools in its hands is to basically cut rates and encourage.
Only tool in its hands.
Well,
not in a bad way, in the sense that the government's got a million tools to do something with.
Yeah.
It's like the old, you know, the federal government are flying this massive, great, you know, 747 or whatever the new model is. What's the new one? Airbus A380. Dials and switches and toggles and everything everywhere. And the poor RBA is flying one plane with one joystick and one red button to push. Either pushes it or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And the government's kind of gone, oh, look, it's a little bit hard for us. Over to you, Phil. You sort it out.
Yeah, well, the government could give everybody a cash check. The government could reduce taxes. The government could, you know, do infrastructure building.
Right, right.
The government could take debt.
And
all sorts of things.
And this is not a political statement, by the way, but they're doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, the old cross-arm salute pointing at the RBA.
Yeah. So, I mean, the RBA did what it could. And, from that point of view, the decisions. I mean, here's the risk, right? The risk with this is it may not actually spur economic activity in the sense that people have seen this drama before. Household debt is high. They might actually not. They might actually just decide to keep the money that they're saving from their mortgages in their banks.
That's kind of the risk, right? So if you look at the numbers, you mentioned households being thrifty. The household savings rate is actually increasing.
Yeah.
So the problem with all economies, we've said this before, is that they all run on confidence. And at some level, the problem is that right now, households are kind of, and to your point, other companies, they're so worried about what might come down the pike. We actually run the very real risk of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think the economy might stall, therefore I'll save some more money, spend less, which, guess what, may well cause the economy to stall. It's one of those things where you kind of want to be careful being right.
That's correct. I couldn't agree more. I think, again, the thing is that, you know, if the rates were higher, then you'd had more ammunition to cut. I mean, you know, 1% is actually, I mean, we are one of the lowest rates now in the developed world.
And you've got to think, I still can't work out, other than that confidence factor, which might be enough, what is any household or any business going to do at 1.25%? They weren't going to do it 1.5. Like, dropping from 4 to 2 over 6 months or 12 months, if you want to stimulate the economy, that makes sense, right? Yeah. And yes, you're right. They probably do something. I just think right now, I think this is a policy issue. And I think it's frankly a government issue. And again, not a political party issue, just a level of government, a responsible entity kind of issue where, I don't see what the RBA frankly can do enough of. And by the way, they run the risk of reinflating some asset bubbles, which were the problem only 12, 18 months ago. It seems to me the government have to really have a good hard look at themselves and say, you know what, we'd be much better with either some government spending or some tax cuts or something that was probably even temporary, and leave rates at 1.5% or 2%, rather than letting the RBA carry the entire can with all the potential ramifications that come with that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree there. Like, I mean, our total mortgage debt, your mortgage is worth $1.6 trillion. It's one of the highest, again, on a per capita basis.
That's a lot of money.
which is the problem, right? If the interest rates go down, it inflates that, and inflates stocks as well, but inflates that asset as well.
Yep.
And what we have basically done, what we have basically at a very high level saying that we have spent $1.6 trillion buying property.
Yep.
Right. And, you know, part of that money could have been spent doing other things that could have actually resulted in, you know, more ongoing activity, more, you know, more new enterprises and so on. So, you know, maybe more risk taking, new enterprises, new jobs, new opportunities. Instead, we just built buildings. So, I mean, that's a policy question.
You've got to live somewhere, dude. Come on.
No, that's not the RBA's issue, right?
Right, I mean,
the RBA can't do anything about policy.
Yep.
But that's, I think, what a larger, broader political policy question. It's not a political question.
All right, let's go to the banks, mate. So, interestingly enough, there's always the dance of who goes first, and the banks seem to take it in turns. I wouldn't allege collusion of any sort, of course. That would be illegal and certainly get me in some trouble if I alleged it, so I won't. But hypothetically, the banks seem to take it roughly in turns. The ANZ was first out of the blocks. They cut rates by, so let's set the scene. RBA cuts by 25 basis points, 0.25%. ANZ comes out and says, we'll cut ours only by 0.18%. And I've got to say, I thought that would probably set the scene for the other banks, but it turns out that ANZ and Westpac passed on only part of the rate cut, while CBA and NAB went the whole hog and passed on the full amount. So there's kind of two issues there. There's the economic issue and there's the PR issue, effectively. Of course, then Treasurer Josh Frydenberg did what every treasurer has done since probably Paul Keating and come out and lash the banks because they didn't pass on the full rate cut because, hey, hang the economics. You've got to be seen to be, you know, ramping, you're kind of giving the banks a hard time because that's the great Australian sport. Are ANZ and Westpac being too cute? Are they being responsible? Are NAB and CBA doing the right thing or the wrong thing? Easy for us to all want to say, well, we all want to pay less on our mortgage, so maybe the right thing is to cut as hard as you can. But for the businesses themselves, who's in the right, who's in the wrong? The guys that passed on the full cut or the ones that didn't?
So no right answer here. But here's the interesting thing. I think one of the arguments made by ANZ was that the reason to not cut, or not pass the full thing, was that depositors are, you know, making it hard or doing it hard. But I think they cut the full rate of 0.25.
I call rubbish on that, by the way.
But I think they actually cut the depositors rate by 0.25 and cut the mortgage rates by 0.18.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Rubbish.
So that was just, I think, PR that actually didn't really work for them. Look, I think there's no right answer. Again, the problem here is this. If the borrowing ratios, if they're borrowing like 40% of money from overseas and it's costing you a certain amount of money to borrow that money, and that rate has not gone down, this rate has gone down, well, you know, if you want to protect your margins, you can't really pass the whole thing.
Right.
Proportionately, you'll have to reduce, pass less. Looks like CBA and NAB are taking a hit on margins. Mm. In with the expectation, I guess, of getting some extra business, right? I mean, it works both ways. So, look, I mean, they're businesses, they got to do, I mean, ultimately, I am actually in favor of strong banks. So the banks being strong and being good businesses is actually overall good for us. So if they're doing the right thing for the business, then maybe it's okay. I mean, people have choice, right? I mean, people can switch from ANZ to whatever else they want to. So, I'm not saying that you should switch, but I mean, you have options. People have options.
I am saying everyone should switch.
We all have options. I mean, maybe if you ask, they'll give you a better rate. You know, that's the thing, right?
Indeed.
You don't know.
Look, man, I'll just tap mine off. I think you're right. I think the reality is that banks are facing rising funding costs from overseas. The reality is that while we all are conditioned, and frankly, this is the problem, right? The banks and the RBA condition us to believe that when the RBA put rates up, the banks are only too fast to put rates up by the same amount, regardless of the funding costs overseas, right? So at some level, they can't say, well, you know, when the rates go up eventually from something to something, when it goes up 25 basis points, the reality is only half-ish of their book will have an increased cost. The funding from overseas won't change. And so to put rates up by 0.25%, they are, by definition, crimping a little bit of margin, right? They could, when the RBA puts up 0.25%, they can effectively put up, I don't know, 16, 17, 18 basis points, something like that, and have their margin stay the same. They don't do that. So on the way down, they can't exactly scream poor because it's not exactly like they've done the right thing in the past. That being said, it does seem to me the right financial decision for the banks and for bank shareholders. I got to say, if you're passing on 0.25% and then hoping to win back some market share, that's a pretty aggressive expectation given how unprepared Australians are to change their banks. We just don't do it very often. So to expect that that's going to be enough to make people change banks, I reckon they've probably overreached a little bit. Now, to be honest, NAB really didn't have a choice. NAB got so bashed up by the Royal Commission. I think they could afford not to, right? They couldn't afford to have another hit to the PR reputation. So I think NAB's probably got a different conversation there internally. Like, you know what? We don't need more grief. We're already in the bad books with the politicians, with the public, with the Royal Commissioner. We just need to do what we need to do. CBA, though, that's the weird one. I think they probably are being a little bit too aggressive. I think they can make up enough market share gain to offset the loss in margin.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, once upon a time, not that long ago, the telcos were among the best and biggest and most popular and most exciting companies on the ASX.
They were the tech stocks.
They were the tech stocks. That's right. Tech and telecom was all the rage. Mm. Poor old Telstra, not really get too much of the joy, but TPG was a $12 stock at one point, maybe even higher.
16 or something.
Vocus was at 9 or 10 at one point. There was Amcom, which was obviously subsumed. The IONet was around for a while. That was bought out as well. Mm. It was the easiest way to make money in the world was to own a telco stock. Then it all changed, and poor old Vocus has just... It can't take a trick, no matter what it does. So Vocus is it's not a particularly strong consumer brand. It's a business that largely provides enterprise-level, company-level telecommunication services, the old dark fiber, so the backbone, the network infrastructure. So it's not necessarily something we come across all the time, although if you wander around one of the CBDs and you look down at one of the pit covers, you'll see the Vocus name printed on some of the telecom pit covers around the cities. It's been a business that really has struggled to get out from under the load of some overpriced, probably ill-timed acquisitions. The business itself can't seem to get enough momentum. And yet again, a takeover offer that hasn't proceeded just recently. Was it a Swedish mob?
It was a Swedish mob.
Swedish mob who said, hey, we'll pay you some money. And then within, a week, they'd walked away? Yeah. What's going on with Vocus, mate? Obviously, there's something there. This is the third time that someone's come sniffing. So there's obviously the kernel of some value there, but no one's going through with the deal. Is this just a broken industry? Is it a broken company? Or is there really value there that the market's missing?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of debt on Vocus's book. And I mean, debt is also a pretty common thing in telco because they have, you know, long-lasting assets and all those things.
And it's kind of a really capital-intensive business. You can't generate enough cash to lay cables and build towers. You kind of need to take debt on, right?
I mean, right now, I think, you know, I actually find it surprising that private equity would be sniffing around. I mean, there's value at some value, and I get it. And the price, as you said, has gone down from, $9 to, $260 or $3, whatever it is right
now. Tough ride.
It's a tough ride. But the thing is this, we are at the cusp of some really significant technology change, right? Mm. So there's 5G coming. If some mob is going to buy something, they really need to be sure that, you know, there's going to be value post all those changes, right?
Yeah.
And NBN has really changed the retail market, right? So the retail market has changed because, you know, basically you've got a big wholesaler that is, you know, basically fixed the price.
Yeah.
And there's not much value prop that you can provide on top of that price to have differential pricing. And then on the backhaul end, I mean, there's, you know, I think Australia's got plenty of backhaul. right? I mean, there's, you know, plenty of companies to offer.
You have to break this down, mate. What's backhaul?
So a backhaul, I mean, like, you know, when you want to do cross-country traffic, carrying cross-country traffic. I mean, there's some competition for carrying traffic across from Australia to overseas.
Right.
But cross-country, you know, not the last mile that, you know, that comes into your building, but
actually
big pipes through which multiple people's traffic goes.
Right, right. So the motorways of the of the telecommunications world. So there's a big motorways that take you from Sydney to Adelaide.
Yeah.
Or Sydney to Melbourne, probably. It's probably not one straight from Sydney to Adelaide. Sydney to Melbourne, and then it branches off at both ends. So you get to Sydney and you're going to go to Potts Point. You get to Melbourne, you're going to go to Dandenong.
Yeah.
The main highways are the backhaul lines.
Yeah, and there's plenty there, right? I mean, there's Telstra provides that, TPG provides that, Vocus provides that, and, you know, there are other new competitors who have actually basically leased services from these guys and are providing services on top of that. So it is like, I mean, there's value at a certain price. It's really a question of, you know, I just think that it's just we're in a transitory period where it's hard to know what's going to happen with the tech. That's number one. Number two is that a big value creating factor in the past was acquisitions and, you know, basically taking a fragmented market with so many other players and basically creating, you know, three or four people. That has really already happened. That has already played through. So, you know, that sort of value creation is not likely to happen. And there's some talk that, you know, somebody like a private equity could acquire it and then sell off its pieces, right? So you could, in theory, do that. And again, you know, whether the sum of parts, maybe they feel that the sum of parts is not equal to the whole and they don't want to buy it.
That's what I find strange. I mean, the insides of any company are always different to what it looks like from the outside.
Absolutely.
But these are pretty known, like pure assets, right? If you think about, if you're an investment bank or a, you know, a private equity mob, you're looking at this from the outside, you kind of know with a reasonable degree of certainty what the assets are, what the market looks like. I mean, again, it's always different on the inside, but to make a bid and then walk away less than maybe a week later, whatever the actual details were, that's a really, really short time to go from, hey, we're prepared to spend billions of dollars to buy you, to, no, we're not spending anything. We're out of here. It strikes me as a strange, strange outcome. I don't know what they would have worked out in a week that took them from, I'm going to pay all this money, to no way in the world.
Well, it could be just an asset quality question, again, as you're saying. Right. It could be an asset quality question that they're just not happy with the asset relative to the price. I mean, I think that's one thing. Again, maybe, you know, the CEO came out and said something about turnaround. I mean, they're trying to make the debt sustainable. So that's the other part, right? I mean, if you're buying this company with all this debt, which is not sustainable, well, then that's not going to be nice. Private equity, by the way, also loves to add debt.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So that option doesn't exist this company, right? So it's really an odd play for private equity in that sense. You can't, you know.
It's almost certainly asset sale.
It's basically asset sale. And if the asset sale is not of high quality, it's basically, to me, it seems like sum of parts doesn't.
They had to have known that going in. That's what I find bizarre.
Well, I mean, you know, you might think from the outside, I mean, it's one thing to look at the books, right? Really look at the books and see what is going on and, get a fine-grained view, granular view of what's going on. So three people walking away is really, like, I mean, that's a flag.
It tells you something, doesn't it?
That tells you something.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, from crying poor to crying babies, how's that for a segue?
That's a great
I'm getting good at this.
You're always good.
Soon enough, they're going to want me on the MMM drive time slot. Kennedy, Malloy and Phillips it's going to be. I'm just going to do the segues. It's going to work, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I think it's
Mick Malloy, Jane Kennedy, if you're listening, I'm available. Give me a call. Nothing's happening, mate. The phone's not ringing.
Well, you know, your producer just you know, he just walked in.
Yeah, he's going to walk out in a minute.
Yeah, he's going to probably walk out again.
He is. Anyway, look, with that wonderful segue, sparkling segue from me, let's move into crying babies and particularly crying Chinese babies. The Chinese infant formula market has been a really great way for Australian infant formula makers to make a mozza. We're thinking about Bellamy's, A2 Milk, more recent one, Bubs, Waddle Health, I think is the other one. There's more of those than there are Australian banks at the moment, which is just bizarre if you think about it. Anyway, they've been making hay while the sun shone in China. Bellamy's had a couple of missteps, but broadly speaking, they're all doing pretty well. Except the Chinese government this week said, yeah, so about that, guys. We actually don't really want just overseas players in the infant formula market. We kind of want to help our own companies to do the same thing. we don't really love the fact that all these, you know, overseas players are coming in and taking up our sector. So they've kind of put the frighteners up Australian shareholders. Shares fell, I want to say, between 5% and 7% roughly for most of the big players, which is a pretty meaningful cross category fall. I want to say that's probably, is that $1 billion in total, do you reckon? Is that enough?
Well, no, I think more than $1 billion just for A2, which is a Kiwi company. You keep calling it Australia. I mean, you know, we should
just, Australasia, mate.
Australasia. Okay.
In the history of Russell Crowe and Farlap and Pavlova, mate, A2 Milk is a great Australian company.
So Russell Crowe's Australian too.
And Credit House.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we know that.
We'll take it.
All right. So what? Give me a bit more colour. What happened in China? What's the future look like for Australian for formula makers?
Okay, so this is, I think, a lot of speculation there. So there's a speculation. This is all speculation because nobody has seen the document in full, and right. No company actually exactly knows what's going on, which is...
YOLO.
Which is a bit of a scary proposition too, right? It's a bit like, you know, those licenses for exporting or stuff into China. So in 2008, there were a number of babies in China died because of the poor quality infant formula that was
contaminated
with, you know, I don't know what animals, dead animals. And that really scarred that market. That resulted in a lot of drive for high quality infant formula from Australia, Europe, Americas, and so on. And that's been, as Chinese wealth has increased, that's really been a big driver for growth here. And our consumer brands have solid, presence.
That's kind of parents all around the world, right? I mean, there's nothing... Any parent is going to do their best for their kid, and if there's a chance that maybe the product they're feeding their child is somehow contaminated or simply not the best possible quality, I don't know many more categories that, particularly these days, people are going to say, well, I don't, you know, I'll eat the food I eat, and I'll drink what I drink, but I want to make sure my kid's got the best available.
Absolutely. Totally. And from not taking thinking from the Chinese point of view, right? I mean, it's been, what, like 11 years past that. It makes sense for them to try to prop their milk industry on its own feet and compete, right? And if they can do it well with proper guide, ensuring safety and quality, it's good for their consumers, which means more competition for our brands. But it's a big market. It's a huge market. And many of our players don't actually own a huge percentage of that market. So it's overall, I don't think... a big deal. It could also, I mean, there's a bit of a trade war connotation here as well. Like, you know, the biggest market players are actually, not Australian in that market.
Yeah.
So it could have a trade war connotation in terms of, you know, let's try to make the cost of doing business for some other, maybe American brands more, increase the cost. So that's that aspect. But finally, the other thing I'd point out is it could also be an opportunity. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at an opportunity. You know, maybe a Chinese company actually wants to acquire, an Australian company and, pay a premium for it. You know, some people, maybe they pay, a 50% premium for Bellamy's and buy it and get access to all the milk that, you know, and a lot of these companies have locked up the milk supply, right? So it's a question of having the milk supply locked up.
And there's kind of a national pride thing too, though, right? Like the Chinese government, in theory, at least if you believe the basis of the speculation rather than insinuating too much, there is some element which is just kind of like, hey, we want Chinese companies doing Chinese milk here, almost trying to wrest back the quality perception among consumers as much as wanting the Australian milk. They're trying to say, well, no, actually, our stuff's okay. We want to have a vibrant local industry.
Yeah, absolutely. But one way of doing that could be that if you are a Chinese milk company, you actually acquire an Australian milk company and call that your subsidiary. I mean, that's like, in your prestige sector, well, I own that company too. I mean, it's a possibility. And it's competition as well. You know, overall, I think, like many of these things, again, if you've got brand power, that brand power is not going to dissipate immediately. It's good for consumers. Consumers are going to compete with, going to have multiple choices. I think it's fine.
Mate, you just wait for the next segue. It's going to be great.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, from Chinese infant formula to Australian financial regulators.
How's that a segue?
That was smooth, wasn't it?
Well,
it's almost the same thing. See how I did that? It's like it's almost like it flows naturally, right?
Yeah, I guess.
That's what I think.
Should we ask Will?
No, I don't know. Will's going to agree with you, not me. I don't want to ask.
Okay.
Will, come on, tell me.
Bad segue.
I agree.
Come on.
I always agree with Doc.
Oh, look out.
Will is an awesome person.
I'm feeling a bit of a power shift here. We might have to cut this pocket. No, I'm kidding. Unbelievable, Will. thought you were on Team Scott over here, but apparently not.
Team Apple, mate.
Oh, we are Team Apple. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, look out. A new war vein opened up. All right. Let's assume that segue was wonderful. Let's move on. AUSTRAC, the government organisation, I should say, that's responsible for making sure the flow of money in Australia is appropriately regulated, has potentially taken issue with the golden child of the ASX right now, Afterpay. Afterpay, of course, buy now, pay later, or pay never, or pay a lot in late fees. I'm not sure exactly what it should be. Maybe that's what it should be. Buy now, pay late fees. BNPLF is what I'm going to call the sector now. Buy now, pay later. Right now, it doesn't fall under the auspices of the Credit Act because it's not officially charging interest to its borrowers. It charges the fee to the retailers instead. So it's not officially credit, which I'm on record as saying I think is a complete debacle, and the regulators really should be stepping up on that one. That's a different question. But AUSTRAC's saying, well, hang on, you need to know who your customers are, what they're doing, what they're spending their money on, the kind of regulations that apply to banks and building societies and other card processes, the Visas and Amexes of the world. AUSTRAC's saying Afterpay maybe needs to know a little bit more and be a little bit more responsible with its lending. Now, Doc, I'm less of an Afterpay bull than you are. Firstly, what's going on? And B, what does it mean for Afterpay's business?
Well, AUSTRAC just doesn't love, retail, people, consumers spending in retail. They don't want people to buy shoes and sneakers and jeans. And
that is a line only someone who has recommended Afterpay could possibly forward.
And you know,
AUSTRAC hates retail. Is that your argument?
There's definitely a lot of money laundering happening when people are buying those jeans and, and going on holidays too, Queensland and things like that. Sure. I mean, that seems like a good use of resources. Look, most of the time people are spending small amounts of money. Yeah.
It's very, very hard to launder $1 million pair of jeans at a time, isn't it?
It's going to be very hard to launder even $10,000. I just don't get this one. And it's good, they're having a discussion. It's good. It looks like a credit product and that's fine. I just the customers. The customers are linked with an account from which they're debited. You therefore know the customers. You know where they're buying stuff from, the retailers, because they have to be accepted at a retailer. I don't know. This, to me, doesn't look like a big deal, but
Is it the triumph of bureaucracy over common sense in your mind?
It looks like, without knowing the finer details, it does, as I said, how are you going to launder with jeans and sneakers and, it's just beyond me. And,
that being said, I mean, it could be more, right? Like, if you take Afterpay to its logical conclusion, and particularly ZipPay is another one that actually does larger amounts of money. This sector is a general. So let's move away from Afterpay specifically for a second. It is possible you could use a buy now, pay later provider to buy thousands of dollars worth of stuff, right? Either immediately or over time. You could potentially, I guess, if you were to buy all of your groceries and all of your jeans and all of your clothes and all of, at some point you could use a buy now, pay later provider for your entire year's spending, as long as you just paid it back later. So I guess at some level, at scale, it's very possible. You could spend 50 grand on Afterpay in a year, couldn't you, if you tried hard?
Maybe you could. But, so it is possible that you could have multiple of these providers.
Right.
The thing is that if you're not being able to pay back, right, the money is being paid back electronically, right? It's not cash transactions. It's not like black money that's coming in. It's not the cash economy. The money has to come from the repayments are coming from a bank account. So, your base truth is really the bank account, right? And if one person wants to have multiple accounts, they still have to have bank accounts I don't know. Again, with all these sort of things, I would say that it's good that they're doing their job. But this doesn't seem like a big deal to me. That's my current take.
Fair enough. I actually tend to agree. I think the AUSTRAC thing is probably overblown. As I said, I'm on record as saying I think this is a credit product that should be, the ability to take on tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt without any of the same checks that are required by credit card companies or personal loan companies or even just mortgage companies. At some level, it feels like a bit of a gap in the financial services system, particularly when it comes to the risks or otherwise it might put the broader economy under, quite frankly, if this is out of control. You've made the point before that buy now, pay later is kind of credit for people who haven't got credit cards, and it extends our spending just that extra bit further. Money that we wouldn't have otherwise had, we're now starting to spend. We're bringing more and more spending forward. It just strikes me that while it doesn't officially fall under the Credit Act, it should be regulated as a credit product, surely.
I don't disagree with that part. It's a type of credit. I don't disagree.
I don't like it when you agree. I feel uncomfortable, like I may have said something wrong or something.
Sometimes, you know, you just buy an Apple Watch and an iPhone.
All right. That's
it. Change to a good computer.
Let's move on.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
I've cleansed the studio. I've sprayed it with disinfectant. There should be no mentioning of fruit companies. After this, we will talk about other things instead. Mate, we've got some mailbag to go through.
And
we won't get through it all because we've got a heap of mailbag, which we love. So thank you very much for sending your messages, questions, comments, thoughts in. We love getting them. We love knowing what you're thinking and answering some of the questions that you're asking us. Mate, the first one I want to talk about is actually a comment rather than a question. And this is, I love a bit of a rant, as you know, mate. Mm-hmm. I got a Twitter message during the week from Lockie. And Lockie says, we just moved from 4.57%, 4.6 rounded up, just to make it easier for the maths, 4.6% with Bankwest to 3.5% with loans.com.au. I originally called Bankwest and the best they could do was 4.07%. Lockie has saved 1.1% on his mortgage. This is before the rate cuts went through, by the way. That is a phenomenal saving. That'll probably save him at least six figures over the life of an average mortgage. I don't know what Lockie's mortgage, I didn't ask. But over an average mortgage, that's that's almost enough to buy a Tesla. That is a spectacular save. So Lockie, A, well done. B, if you're listening to this, a mini rant, please, for the love of God, call your bank. Doc's already mentioned it. Go and ask for a better rate. I've got a little bit of a hashtag going on Twitter. I'm the only one who's using it so far, Doc. But from little things, big things grow. Mm-hmm. Paul Kelly told me that. From get a better rate. Hashtag get a better rate. Jump on Twitter. Share the love. Let us know if you've been able to negotiate a better rate. Encourage some other people. Every time I do this and put it on Twitter, I get two or three or four people come back and say, yeah, I just called the bank and made some money. A couple of people saved 0.5%, 0.6% with a 5-minute phone call. So A, jump online. Or firstly, call your bank. Go and get a better rate. Then jump online. Tell us about it. Use the hashtag get a better rate. Not the world's sexiest hashtag, but it works for me. Get a better rate because, frankly, the banks don't need the money. And if you want to donate 100 grand to a bank, do me a favor, give it to me instead. Give it to Doc. Doc and I'll go halves. If you don't need the 100 grand that you could save by going to the bank, give it to me. Give it to Doc. Just throw us a great party. Give us some love. Hire a skywriter. Do something. But for the love of God, don't give your banks more than you have to. They don't deserve it. Feel better now.
You just hate the banks.
I hate bank customers paying more than they have to. It drives me nuts. In what I'm not even going to start again.
Motley Fool Money.
All right, mate. We got a question from Dean. And Dean says, Scott and Doc, he says, the Motley Fool Money and your erudite musings are the light of my week every week. Dean, all I can say is, mate, get a life. We're not that good. Seriously. if this is the best part of your week, have a good hard look at yourself. But we do love the positive praise, and got you a mention on Motley Fool Money, so that can't be bad. He's got a question which was directed to me, but I'll ask you first, Doc, because I think you and I share some of the same thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I'll phrase the question as asked to me, because I won't necessarily tar you with my brush. Then I'll ask you for my thoughts. Dean says, question for Scott, why are you so negative on short sellers? Don't they provide a useful counter narrative? That's his question. Doc, tell me what you think about short sellers, and I'll tell you what I think about short sellers.
So my biggest issue with short sellers is just, I don't have a problem with a different opinion. Don't buy the stock, right? I mean, if you think the stock is not for you, don't buy it, right? What the short seller really does is, before actually shorting the stock, which is borrowing and selling, right? They actually first borrow and then sell, then release a big report saying, oh, all these things are really bad about this stock. You should sell it. This is going to zero. This is going negative. This is going bust, blah, 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 blah.
Seen plenty of those.
Right. So we've seen plenty of, there'll be these huge, humongous, 200-page reports.
Yeah.
Like, if you really think a company's that bad, you should have just, sent that information out, put it out before you actually do any of these shenanigans, right? So what is there to know that what they're saying is correct? So they do what I call a lot of retail investor FUD. They create, uncertainty, right?
FUD being fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Doubt, yeah. Nice. So you create fear, uncertainty, and doubt. You try to drive the poor retail investor out of the stock. Mm-hmm. And that's how you actually try to drive. And then you hope that some momentum investor is going to get in and it's going to drive the price down, right? So,
okay, but I don't necessarily disagree with you, but let me pour out the counter argument. People could say, and rightly, are probably yelling at their podcast machine right now. Podcast machine is an official term. It's a thing that plays the soundy things that we do. They're yelling at their podcast machine now saying, well, hang on, you bastards are putting out positive recommendations. Maybe you own the stock, maybe you don't. Then you go and say, hey, company X is great. Aren't you doing the same thing in reverse? Aren't we just doing on the long side exactly the same thing as the short sellers are doing on the short side? In other words, we may or may not be buying up front. Then we go and say this is great. And with legitimate reason, we believe it is. And the share price goes up because we happen to be right. Aren't we doing exactly what we're accusing the short sellers of doing, just in reverse?
So the ramping on both sides is ramping, right? I mean, if you're buying...
To be clear, I'm not saying we ramp, by the way. Either way, right? Putting out a... Even if it's not ramping, it's literally, hey, we shorted the stock. Here's what we genuinely believe. We have no intention of ramping necessarily, although we can argue that. We're just saying, hey, we bought the stock. We think it's going to go down. We sold the stock short. Then we put out a report saying, here's why. If they're right, aren't they entitled to make money from it?
Well, they are, but I think, you know, there's this, you can create this narrative around, you know, a lot of fear, and you can create this narrative around a lot of uncertainty, right? You can carry, it's in all of those things, actually, you know, people have a tendency to react to those. You know, people don't react necessarily to positive information as they might react to negative information, right? So, I don't know. Like, I mean, a lot of the times they also create fake narratives, right? So they create, you know, there's no, you know, nobody's prosecuting anyone here, right? I mean, if somebody actually put out a fake report, there's no way to actually tell or that, you know, they have put out a fake report and therefore they should be charged for it, right? So I don't know. I think, you know, if you want to short it, sure, but I mean, you know, I would rather have them put out the report. So I just find the mechanism behind that a little odd.
Look, first of all, I'm massively negative on short sellers. That's Perdoon's question, and here's my thinking. Right, I think the markets have been, I'll say, corrupted. I don't mean necessarily illegally corrupted in the sense of kind of, you know, the wrongdoing. I think they've been misused. And I think that the movements of the market has gone from being a place where buyers and sellers can exchange parts of a business, which is what they're designed to do, to being effectively, we hear about casino capitalism. It's used kind of as this negative term. I think in some cases that's kind of right. Now, I know you use some derivatives, so I'm treading on a little bit of shaky ground here with you. But broadly speaking, I think, you know, the idea is that if you bought and sold shares of a company, BHP, just pick a big name that everyone knows, if you and I exchange an ownership interest of BHP for some cash, that's what the markets are designed for. When it starts to become a place of, hey, how can we use this reasonable mechanism, this kind of, you know, regulated market, to start making some bets effectively on future movements of things that are kind of tangentially related to the underlying security, that's the issue I have. Options, derivatives, short sellers, it all becomes financial kind of gambling and betting. Now, yes, if you own a share of a business, you're betting on its future, but you're buying and exchanging the underlying asset itself, not some sort of derivative bet, right? It's not that far away from putting $5 on horse number 3 at Harold Park on Tuesday night, right? It's a whole different story about how markets are supposed to operate, what they're actually there for. Yes, it's legal. Yes, it is possible. I just don't know that it's necessarily the right approach to be taking as a market, as a regulated market. Do we really want our stock markets turned into, I mean, think about the GFC, right? The GFC happened in part because house prices collapsed. That was maybe unavoidable, maybe not. The bigger issue, though, was the ramifications were caused by the financial bets that were placed on the housing market, the collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs. That didn't need to exist. And if they didn't exist, it would have been a very, very different story when it came to the ramifications, the kind of the ripple effect of the housing collapse in the US. It still would have been painful. It still would have hurt. It sort of, you know, spiked unemployment and all those things. It would not have been anywhere near as bad or as contagious had it not been those financial kind of instruments that were created on the back of the housing market to try and make some money for some shiny bums in a high-rise tower on Wall Street. So, you know, I don't think it's necessary. Do they provide a counter-narrative? Yes, they do. You can get that other places, you've already said, Doc. You can absolutely make that counter-narrative if you want. By the same token, it's just not a necessary part of any other market. There's nowhere else in kind of financial life or even personal life where we have that, you know, necessity for something else going on that can't otherwise be provided without a financial bet being placed on the shares going down. I don't think it adds to the market. I don't think it adds any value to the market net. And to your point, Doc, the last thing I would say is, and you made exactly the right point, which is people feel fear about 3 times, we know from psychology, as much as they feel the pain of loss about 3 times as much as they feel the joy of gain. What that means is if you and I put out a positive report on BHP, again, to pick a random name, shares might go nowhere or up a tiny bit. As soon as you see a big short selling report, we feel fear so dramatically that shares will fall meaningfully, 5, 15, 10%, something like that. We've seen that so many times. Corporate Travel, a company I own shares in, it's a recommendation of ours, so I'm horribly biased on this one. You know, when everything's good, the shares might go up a little bit, maybe they don't go up at all. When the short sellers come out, the shares went from $30 to $18 in very short time, now back to 22-ish. It remains to be seen whether the short sellers are eventually right or not. They may well be. I don't think so, but they may well be. The problem is that that's kind of driven the share price down because of that fear, uncertainty, and doubt that you talk about. And I just don't think that's a very useful part. And frankly, you know, I don't think our market should be structured so that people are making money from that kind of bet, which is literally, you know, a financial bet as opposed to an investment in the underlying asset itself.
Modly Fool Money.
Mate, I've got a diversification question from one of our listeners I think we'll finish with today. Dave asks a question. He says, good morning, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast. Hey, hey. He says, you guys are doing a great job. Dave, that's very kind of you to say. I don't know why people always give us compliments, Doc.
Yeah, I think you asked for them.
I might have, but don't say that.
That's not a big part of it.
I'm sure they don't even realise, mate. They probably haven't even thought of it. They're probably just being genuinely positive and lovely. Mm. Dave, thank you for the kind words. He says, I've been listening for a while now. You guys advocate to get to 15 diversified shares as quickly as you can. Absolutely, we do. He says, do you count ETFs as one company share? So say I have 7 different ETFs and 3 companies in a portfolio. Would you still say I only have 10 different shares, or do ETFs count for more as they cover a range of companies? Keep up the good work. Thanks, Dave. This is an awesome question, mate. So to recap, we do say absolutely try and get to 12 or 15 companies. We've stolen that from our co-founder, David Gardner. Try and get to 10 or 15 companies as quickly as you possibly can, simply because it gives you a more diversified portfolio, particularly when you're starting. It means one company's movements don't have an outsized impact on your portfolio. It just means you're less likely to be scared out of the market by individual events, individual circumstances. So that's why we say it. There's no direct kind of purely rational reason to do it. You could build it in a very, very different way and end up at the same place. But we know behaviorally, psychologically, we're just going to be better as investors, better as people, if we diversify the impact of one particular event or circumstance on our portfolio. So that's why we say 12 to 15, just for those who've come in late. But Dave says, well, hang on, say I've got 7 ETFs or 5 ETFs, pick whatever number you want. Is that really still only 5 or 7 positions, or should it count for more? What say you, Doc?
It's a very interesting question, again, with no...
Isn't it a good one?
It's a great one.
I really
one.
Love
actually,
this question. It was really
question,
clever.
Dave.
Yeah.
High five for actually asking us as a fantastic question.
We're stalling for time, aren't we?
Yeah. So I think number one, it really depends on the type of ETF, right? So if the ETF is like...
That's a great point, by the way.
Yeah, so if the ETF is an ASX 200 ETF,
yep.
Then you've got diversification in terms of companies. You've got 200 companies that you own, but mm-hmm. you put like 35% of your money on banks and miners and things like that.
Right.
So that's probably not the type of... It's not giving you... It's giving you diversification, but not great diversification, right? So depending upon...
So that's worth some multiple of companies, but maybe not a whole index
by itself. So, I mean, if you've got a range of different ETFs that cover different parts of the market and therefore, by definition, gives you access to different sectors, different mm-hmm. regions, different geographies, different growth rates... different number of companies, then yes. I mean, then you know, you can technically run a portfolio with just a few ETFs. Yeah. I mean, that would be pretty diversified if it is done properly. It's sometimes hard to do, but it can be done. So I'm inclined to say yes, but with the caveat that it depends on what you own. If it's heavily concentrated in certain sectors and those sectors actually result in having some companies with very heavy weights, then it's not as diversified.
Mm-hmm.
But an ETF definitely counts as more than one. Even if it's an ASX 200 ETF, right? It still counts as more than one. It's better than like if you own 3 banks and instead you own ASX 200 ETF, the ASX 200 ETF is by definition more diversified.
Right. I can't have much more to that, mate, but I like the sound of my own voice, so I'm going to try. You did right. I love about this question was the thinking about what it means for diversification. And Doc, to your point, so I'll put a couple of extra points on your comments. I'll basically amplify some of the things you said. In terms of, it depends on what sort of ETF, I think it's a great question. ETFs, again, we kind of make the point, and you and I tend to fall into the view and kind of the trap potentially, I was about ETFs if they're one thing. And they always were, right? The index fund idea of an ASX 200 ETF or a S&P 500 ETF in the US, that's the traditional index fund approach where you're getting broad diversification, broad exposure to a whole market or a whole index. And that's a really, really good thing. These days, though, an ETF doesn't have to be that. An ETF, by definition, is just an exchange-traded fund. It can be any fund for any purpose. you can have a double leveraged gold ETF, which is risky for a million different reasons, but we, you know, that's not the same as an S&P 500 ETF. So, you know, you're getting leverage exposure just to one particular mineral, as opposed to a metal, as opposed to a broad index. So, and I don't know what Dave's question was. I'm pretty sure he wasn't talking about a double leveraged gold ETF for the record. But just to clarify for those who are listening, you know, not all ETFs are the same. They don't all serve the same function. Frankly, for the most part, we say stay away from specific ETFs unless you have a particular investment theme. And that's probably a question we can dwell on later. But if we're talking about broad ETFs, which I think Dave is, then yes, you know, an ETF is worth more than just a market. In fact, you know, I think you could. The average investor, if you wanted to, and you're probably not the average investor because you're listening to this, unless you're doing it for my segues and jokes, which is wonderful, and thank you. Please tell your friends. If you know, I think you can just hold a couple of diversified ETFs and that's it. You know, to the point of 12 to 15 stocks, we're talking about stocks, individual businesses here. If you owned just an S&P 500 ETF and an ASX 300 ETF, for example, you could be very, very happily adding to that for the rest of your working life. There'll be fluctuations and volatility, but you're diversifying away almost all of the available risks you can by simply giving yourself geographic, currency, industry, sector diversification with those two ETFs. So, you know, you don't need 15 of them. Two very, very broad ETFs would be more than enough, I think, if you wanted to do it that way. So as you think about your portfolio, yeah, I think that's right. That being said, if your ETF is one out of 10 or one out of 15 stocks, there's not that much diversification given by the ETF because you're talking about fractions of fractions. So if you've got, let's make it 20 because the math is easier. If you've got 20 positions and 1/20th is an ETF, is it worth two or three companies? Well, maybe, except that the other 19 are going to have far, far more of an impact on your portfolio than that extra ETF. So I would say the number of companies you need to own is proportional to how big your ETF exposure is as a proportion of your portfolio. If it's half your portfolio, you may only need another 5 or 7 companies. If it's 1/10 of your portfolio, you probably need more. If it's 1/20 of your portfolio, well, it kind of isn't adding too much diversification at all. That one position is diversified, the other 19 aren't necessarily. So the more stocks you have, and the smaller the ETF is, the more you need to think about, ironically, diversification. If you've only got a couple and they're both ETFs, I think that's probably perfectly fine. Just be mindful that you are going to still feel the movements of the market, but you're not going to be exposed to those sorts of risks they otherwise might be taking. Any more thoughts on that, Doc?
No, sir. I think that they covered it. You've covered it, everything.
Speaking of diversification,
mm-hmm.
I've got nothing. There's no segue there.
Oh, I thought you were going to... That's, you know, you're letting me down here.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of diversification, let's diversify away from this podcast and go back to work.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
It's not aggressive, is it? Will's giving me the so-so. Mate, that's it. That's even generous, just quietly. that was woeful. About my worst thus far, except for maybe my infant formula financial regulation thing. That was pretty ordinary too.
You'll fix it with the Triple M Whisper. That's high quality.
Hey. Tell you what, I'm all about bringing the value, mate. All about bringing the value. Speaking of which, that wraps us up this week. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your enemies, tell anybody, tell everybody who couldn't use a little bit of foolish insight in their lives. And you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox. Speaking of the Triple M Whisper, by going to www.fool.com.au/Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight and maybe a segue or two. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/Triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.